Welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us on the show this week. My guest is West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. We'd love to have your questions for him during the next half hour. You can call those in to area code 765-496-1999. You can go to ask@WBAA.org and send an email there. You can also tweet us at WBAA News on Twitter. Mr. Mayor, good afternoon. How are you?
Good, Stan. How are you doing?
Pretty good. And speaking of tweeting, I wanted to start the show with this. We got a fair amount of response to our conversation on last month's show about the needle exchange possibilities, the possibility of a mobile exchange specifically in Tippecanoe County. And I wanted to relay to you a couple of the tweets we got. One says, why is at Mayor John Dennis walking away from this program when they have the resources and we've seen what happens when needle exchanges are axed? And another slightly snarkier one says, Eagleton Mayor says he's comfortable letting Pawnee shoulder the burden of drug treatment. Someone who's obviously a Parks and Rec fan. So you told me last month, in all seriousness,
that was just mean, though.
in all seriousness, as you were leaving the station last month, you said to me, I think my heart is in it, but my head hasn't gotten around it. And I wanted to know if you'd gotten any more response similar to what we got in the wake of that program and what the last month has been like as the conversation has kind of swirled around a little bit.
Well, it is. I am really divided about it because as a human being that cares about my fellow man, it's really distressing to see what can happen when things like this aren't properly managed. And there are truly people out there that are in need. They're in need of those services. They're in need of making sure that even though what they're doing isn't something that's been sort of blessed by society, it's still creating a need for health care and it's still creating a need to be monitored. But I fall back on logic, and sometimes in emotional issues, logic really isn't the best place to default. And I, if there is to be a program, and I think that there is, if it's not happening as we speak, at some point in our near future, this program will be mandated. I think the state legislature is looking at at that as a possible option, but I could be wrong.
That would be interesting because right now only, I think, 9 of the 92 counties in the state have talked about this in any serious way.
Well, I think that because, and again, we're sort of bouncing around here. I know that some of the folks at the state level have the same level of understanding that an opioid problem is one of the bigger problems that we have now in the state of Indiana. You know, between that and making sure that we've got, you know, a ready job workforce, I mean, that's what's keeping a lot of people up at night. And with our legislature, I think that there is that possibility that they might come down with something that would pretty much bless a needle exchange program throughout the state. And with that understanding, I think it gets back to where's the best place to have them, and then how are you going to be able to provide the essential services for those programs? And I am strongly supportive of the program being where the problems are. And in West Lafayette, it just doesn't seem to suit. And again, people can accuse me of waffling or being a coward or just being bullheaded, but I firmly believe that when you look at the population base that you're serving, you look at how the programs are run, it needs to be where the problem basically originates and where you can have the most impact.
So let me put it in a slightly more polite way than the person who made the person who made the Parks and Rec comment. And I mean, what that person is getting at is that they're drawing a line between what does West Lafayette do and what does Lafayette do. You and Mayor Wazworski are on this program all the time talking about greater Lafayette, about how we are, in a lot of ways, one larger community that is relatively homogeneous, that you're trying to bridge that gap, to not let the river be a dividing line between the two, but to think about it as one cohesive society. So as you're making the argument of put the solution where the problem occurs, isn't there a sensible thought that the problem is in greater Lafayette?
Sure. I mean, you could think that, but when you look at what's been taking place currently, we have a brand new methadone clinic.
Right.
It's in downtown Lafayette. There's a reason why it's in downtown Lafayette. We have some outreach programs that are specific to homelessness, that are specific to mental health issues, that are specific to drug and alcohol abuse, that are predominantly housed in Lafayette. And in West Lafayette right now, the necessary infrastructure isn't there. And that's just generally speaking. Then let's talk more specifically about this particular demographic. We're talking about drug addicts who, even though we try and condition folks to understand what's in their best interest, don't necessarily pull that card out of the deck. It's a challenge to do it no matter where you go. In Bloomington, for example, we've had some conversations with the administration over at Bloomington and with some of the police folks over there as well. And they are very, very divided on how successful that program's been. They show an increase in crime. They show a lot of the needles that are being distributed are not being exchanged. I've seen pictures of open sewer grates that are just basically filled with dirty needles. And that type of concern is the concern that a lot of folks, specifically in law enforcement and some of the leadership in elected office, have. Because one of the things that we do when we take these jobs is we want to make sure that our communities are protected, that they're safe, that we look after our population base. And to some degree, bringing in a program like that could confuse that. But on the other side, it's important that if we do bring a program like this into our community, again, talking in the generic both sides of the river concept, that we do it in a way where it's going to be successful. If we're addressing a problem, which is the spread of disease, if we're addressing a problem, which is an arguable criminal issue, it's got to be in a place where it's going to have that level of impact. And I just do not believe that West Lafayette is that place.
Let's move on to other things. You mentioned the city of Bloomington. We got a question in from Michael, who writes, what chance is there that West Lafayette will follow the lead of Bloomington's mayor's embrace of solar energy for city installations and encouragement for citizens to take advantage of state incentives that will expire at the end of December of this year?
Yeah, that was cool. I read about that in the paper this morning. Fair play to the guy in Bloomington. Even though it's the mayor of Purdue, I guess I shouldn't say that, should I? We just recently met with our Go Greener Commission. I signed for the mayor's climate change thing about after specifically what the president did with the Paris climate change initiative. And part of what we're doing is we're having our Go Greener Commission provide the guidance to my department heads insofar as what we are doing as a city and further that even as a community. We actually had Diane D'Amico and Lindsay, and I'm going to forget her last name. Sorry about that, Lindsay, at our staff meeting yesterday, at Lindsay Payne, at our staff meeting yesterday to help us understand about how we can quantify what we're doing. A lot of that has to do with your carbon footprint, and specifically with your carbon footprint. But more importantly, it's about how we do operations, and it does include the concept of solar energy. Now, again, like Bloomington, when you look at the size of our community, there are certain things that we can do very much so that would help us, you know, actually utilize solar energy and try and do things to help better off the environment as a whole. But we need to start somewhere. We need to get that guidance, and we need to make sure that it's not cost prohibitive. As always, you know, it's not our money. It's money of our taxpayers, and we need to be careful how we spend that. And so we're going to start off by doing the right thing with our carbon footprint, just looking at the operations that we have. Can we likely progress towards having solar energy? I think so. I think so. But again, it's a rather far step from where we are right now to where we eventually hope to be.
Are you looking at just solar, or are you looking at other forms of green energy too?
Oh, always. We try and keep all of our options open, yeah. And the cool thing about being a university community is that we've got a lot of smart folks running around here that are coming from all over the country and actually all over the world. And they really do come up with some great ideas. Unfortunately, a lot of their experience is based upon a long-term effect of some of these programs and products that are being utilized. And we're still in that infancy stage. You know, we've done a great job in trying to clean up our riverfronts. We're doing a great job about making sure that we're green. But a lot of that focuses on recycling and some mild energy reduction usage issues. There's a lot of room for improvement. And obviously, solar energy is one. And unfortunately, there is a timeline to this now if they're going to start taking away the credits.
Right. Well, our question askers are doing a good job segueing from one to each other this week. Brian has written in and says, Greater Lafayette is going through a building boom. It also has a long and strange attraction to parking lots, he says, that could never be filled even in the salad days of retail. He says, see Sagamore Parkway, Teal Road, 52 South Street, etc. He says, we seem to be throwing down asphalt and concrete and tossing up buildings without concern to the heat island effect. We don't have much canopy and we're losing green space. What specific laws or statutes, etc., have our government leaders passed and enforced to halt this dangerous trend? And he says, if you don't believe me, see the red flag being waved down in Louisville. They are reeling over this issue. And so his point is, the more concrete you have, the more you are increasing the greenhouse effect by reflecting that sunlight back and making it warmer and warmer and warmer. And he's worried that we're going to go overboard, I think.
And that is absolutely valid. In West Lafayette, we are one of the few communities in the state that actually we have a green space requirement. Hypothetical. If somebody's going to come in and put in a, you know, a Walmart or a name that favorite store, we make sure that a certain percentage of that structure and that parking area is going to have green space on it. And again, those are standards that were developed 10 years ago. So we probably are in a position to where we could tweak them now. But it also allows for us to apply that strategy towards new construction or major remodel. Again, if somebody were – they had a car wash and they were going to turn it from a car wash into a used car lot, there would be a requirement that they would have to meet the green space requirements. And that really does help us insofar as that heat reflection issue.
Do you think those requirements are in need of updating?
I'd have to talk to our green space manager and see. But I believe so because I see a lot more concrete than I do trees. The other side of it is, though, is that with the green space requirement and with the way that we approach that, it needs to be in conjunction with how we are sort of moving along as a society. We all, both sides of the river and probably any major community in the state, have parking requirements. And that's the unfortunate reality of having all this asphalt and concrete. You know, when businesses plunk their businesses in our community, there has to be a guarantee of a certain number of parking spaces, either in front of the business or in conjunction with the business. Take example in the Levy area where we're doing the State Street project. We'll allow them to rent or buy parking garage spaces so they can still meet that threshold. But that was all predicated on some of the science that we used some time ago. When everybody got in a car, everybody drove somewhere, everybody needed to park right in front of where they're going to go patronize that business, they could come back out real easily and get in their car and go back home.
Well, and it seems like some of the developments, for instance, that are going up along State Street are going to have underground parking as well.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it is to meet that old standard. But I don't know of a city leader in at least in this state and specifically in this area, and I know a few of us, that's willing to run that risk that there is going to be a decrease in the volume of cars. As we progress, though, I can see that happening. We have you know, bike lending programs. Every road project that we do now has a bike and pedestrian trail. When you look at the data about 16-year-olds getting their driver's license, I know when I was 16, I got mine when I was 16, 1 month and 1 day. They're waiting a little bit longer now. Public transportation is becoming more and more of a focal point for progressive communities. And we're in that same driver's seat, no pun intended, to take care of that kind of opportunity right now. And the State Street Project reflects some of that philosophy. Now, again, the dark side of that is when we work with all these other groups that sort of control how development goes, whether it be APC, whether it be some of our own internal mechanisms that we have to abide by those standards until a greater authority can assist us in making those changes.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking today with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. You can call in your questions at 765-496-1999. Email them to ask@wbaa.org or tweet at WBAA News on Twitter. Teresa has written in to say, I live in Barbary Heights and I noticed the addition of cross traffic does not stop signs under stop signs on several intersections. She says, thank you for doing this. It's cleared up some confusion for drivers who are not familiar with the neighborhood. There's another place, she says, that could benefit from these signs on Nighthawk Drive right in front of University Square. She says there are two stop signs for traffic heading east and west. Can you please put signs under those that say cross traffic does not stop? Yesterday, I did call the street department and the engineer's office, she says.
And did she say what they said?
She did not indicate whether she had gotten an affirmative or a negative response.
Well, the good thing is she can call and make a recommendation. I can get in touch with those guys and give them a directive. So we'll go ahead and look at that. But there is kind of an interesting thing about street signs, street lights, and all that kind of stuff. If you'll let me talk about it. Can I talk about those things?
Sure.
You're dying to know these things, aren't you, Steve?
I am.
I mean, we're kind of like open the vault of the city
this
stuff.
This is the beauty
here.
Of radio is the listeners don't know that I'll be taking a nap in the corner while you talk about this.
If we hear you snoring, folks out there, it's Stan.
That's
not
right,
me.
Yeah.
But a lot of these intersections have different ownership. Some of it's on private property, so we have to go through a different process with that. Some of it's the state. I was out running this past Sunday, and there's some guys riding by on a bike, on their bikes, and they stopped me and they said that the intersection at Cumberland and 231, the pedestrian passing or the pedestrian signals aren't working correctly. And so I tell them, you know, the usual mayoral, I'm on it, you know, yay.
And I go to that intersection at least twice a day, and it seems like there's a lot of bike ped traffic intersection.
There really is. And it's unfortunate because a lot of them, when they're crossing 231, the timing is so subjective. It can be a challenge sometimes. But it's not our intersection. And that's a state-run intersection. So what happens is they tell me, and I get, you know, my folks to go ahead and get a hold of the state, even though their office is about 600 yards down from that particular intersection, it goes into that state feeder system that they drop. They give it a number, they give it a location, and then they find the guy who's responsible for it, and they give it to that guy who finds a guy who gets a guy who finds an engineer who goes out and fixes it. So that's one thing that always causes these things to be delayed. Other things require a traffic study to be able to modify. And that's a little bit more involved.
Let me ask you about that, because we hear a lot from all of you mayors who are on the show about the idea of traffic studies. And, you know, you'll see those couple of black strips that go across to determine what's traffic flow and all that. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that there are some places where it is such common sense. Or you could go and you could stand there for half an hour.
No, this is government, man. What do you – common sense.
I know. But you were just talking about being a progressive community. And by the way, you should be careful with that P word based on the party you're in.
Oh, right.
That's right. They don't like that.
No, they don't.
And so there are some places where you could go out, you could stand there for half an hour and go, well, clearly the walk, don't walk sign is not doing what it's supposed to do. Mm-hmm. Let's just fix it.
Yeah.
Why does it need a traffic study?
That kind of thing doesn't. But when you're talking about changing the direction of traffic, changing the rate of speed of traffic, changing the flow of traffic, that does. And the oddity is that because, you know, let's just take West Side as an example, because I guess I'm the mayor there. We have a couple different traffic concentration periods as opposed to other communities that have the work clock, you know, traffic concentration issue. We've got schools that get out at different times. We have school buses that run up and down the roads at different times. And we've got a major university that has, I think, what is it, 13 or 16,000 employees that work here that leave at different times.
And a whole bunch of different passing periods when school's in session.
Yeah, that's a completely different animal. But we're just talking about vehicular traffic now. And so for us to be able to make an informed decision, and notice I didn't say intelligent, I said an informed decision, we need to do some of these studies. The other thing is that gives us a default. It gives us a way of explaining to people why things went the way they did. Because, you know, if we put a stop sign somewhere, somebody's going to call me up and rip my backside because they think that's illogical. You know, I drive here at this time every day and there's never anybody here. What'd you put a stop sign there for? And then the mom coming to and from school will be there at the intersection where people are basically playing Russian roulette to see who can get into the intersection first.
So let me ask about the idea of resources, because you probably don't have the resources to do all of the traffic studies that you'd want to do simultaneously. Mm-hmm. How do you prioritize when, you know, pedestrians in different places find you on your run and say, here, here, and here, we need to be looking?
Well, believe it or not, a lot of it is through citizen complaint. Sometimes it's through accident volume. You know, you have these intersections where, you know, 20 years ago, it was chirp, chirp. Nobody was ever out there. And then as we develop and grow, more people get there. And there's people that, you know, run into each other sometimes. So accident volume is another way to judge it. And the other is just by looking. Our engineer guys are really pretty smart. And just by looking out there and seeing things that just don't look quite right, or knowing that there is a plan development for that particular location and doing a pre-study there. That way we can predetermine based upon the number of parking spaces, which is really kind of segueing into a conversation that we had in the past, and use that as a tool to evaluate, sort of to pre-evaluate, to make sure that we're going to be able to have the proper signalization so that things will go safely.
One more question that's come in is from Phil. He says, I have a question about the construction timetable for the East Brown Bridge on 52. He says, I haven't seen any workers or construction activity on that bridge in a very long time. This may be covered in an existing website already, but I thought I'd ask just to hear the verbal explanation of its current status.
Well, actually, the state is actually following the guidance of our electric company. They're going to make all the bridges underground now. And so you're not actually seeing that.
Going under the river.
Yeah, under the river. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You don't buy it, do you?
The chunnel of the West chunnel. Lafayette and Lafayette.
Collecting West Lafayette. That's good. I'm going to run with that one.
There you go.
No, actually what it is that we've had a great deal of rain this year. And the, where they are right now in the construction project of that south leg is they've got to get the pylons knocked into the ground so they could put the concrete around them so they can build the stable base for the bridge. And the weather has just been prohibitive. And so usually what happens is that there is an understanding of how if the river is so far over the banks, the flow is going so quickly that there will be a rather – easily calculable timeline before you could actually get back into it and start doing your work again. So,
well, to say nothing of the possible danger to people doing the work.
There you go. And the thing that happens is these crews, you know, we like to believe that when we have a crew doing a particular project, that's all they got to worry about, just that one project. And unfortunately, it's not so. So when the crews aren't busy doing something, say, here in Greater Lafayette, they might go to Kentucky. Or they might go up to Chicago area, or they might go someplace else, and then we have to get them back in here and get them back to work.
So once again, our astute listeners doing a nice job of segueing for me. We talked about the rain there. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the rain that's affected the State Street project. That's just one of a number of things that brought you guys right up to the point where your city development director, Eric Carlson, a couple weeks ago told me you have basically zero wiggle room left in terms of trying to meet that August 14th deadline to get it open through most of the Purdue campus by the time that students come back. And now you've had, what, two gas main strikes in the last couple of days?
Yeah. Yep.
How has that affected the timeline?
Well, not at all. And thank you for the opportunity to say something about that date, August 14th. We are actually, we as the city of West Lafayette, we're hosting a welcome back party that day. And you're going to see about 50 of my employees, myself included, wearing bright blue T-shirts standing up and down State Street from about Harry's to about just a little bit past Triple X. And the hope we're going to be on both sides of the road. We're going to be welcoming students back. We're going to be giving out information on how to get around.
Let me ask the question that every parent is now thinking. Will they help me carry the heavy stuff to the dorm room?
Well, I'll go ahead and call my street department. I got Ben Anderson. He's about 6'6", 300 pounds. He can carry anything. We are so committed to that date, and every day we get, well, you know, periodically every day we get updates, and there has been nothing, you know, whether it be the weather, whether it be the gas lines, whether it be anything that has deterred us from using that as a target date. And the cool thing of it is that the companies that are involved in this project, it is in their financial best interest to make sure that they meet those dates.
Sure.
So, I mean, foregoing any incredibly odd act of God like a tornado or, you know, a tsunami that started in the Wabash.
Should point out that there is the possibility of severe rain mere hours after this program airs.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We're looking at dark clouds as we're, you know, coming in. But they tell us, we believe them, and we're still all green light for the 14th, and we're going to have a pretty cool celebration to prove it. So it'll probably be raining.
It'll probably be raining.
It'll probably be raining, you know.
Well, so, I mean, how is it that two gas main strikes in 2 days doesn't affect the timeline? How is that even possible?
Well, it's easy because, I mean, the gas mains, you go in there, you dig them up, you cap them, and then you go back to work. The gas mains themselves, the greater challenge is why does it happen? You know, the presumption is that when people come in and do the pre-construction stuff, they show all these lines and they say, here's a gas line, here's an electric line, this is a conduit for...
Sure, you see all kinds of spray painting on the street.
Yeah, really, you look at the blueprint, the engineering blueprint, it looks like spaghetti. But it never ceases to amaze me how they come across things that they didn't know were even there. And it's happened 2 days in a row with the gas lines. They weren't even... On the map, they weren't even shown.
And people will remember that this happened with River Road as well.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. And so all we can do is, you know, have a plan B and triage the units that are going to fix them, get them in here, get them repaired, and get back to work.
Well, right. But the plan B still eats up hours or mm-hmm. days mm-hmm. that would otherwise be getting you toward that August 14th deadline.
Yeah. But we also have internal stuff that we do. We've actually... twice this year suspended our noise ordinance so these guys can work through the night. The good thing about doing here in a college community, there's nobody here yet. So the only people that we're disrupting are the kids leaving Harry's in the middle of the night and just having to tell them to go a different route.
Let's get on to a couple more things in our last couple of minutes. A federal judge has ruled that the way that the county lets people protest on the courthouse grounds was in violation of the First Amendment. The county has subsequently written a new rule I wondered what you thought of how that had gone down from having to have a federal judge say, no, you can't just capriciously decide, county commissioners, who you want to protest and who you don't on mm-hmm. the courthouse grounds, to the county's new rule, which is designed to kind of go completely the opposite direction, according to Doug Masson, the county attorney, who I talked to a week or two ago. Why did it, in your mind, take sort of that act of a court to say, well, look, you're clearly in violation of the First Amendment?
I don't know. Maybe I told you I was going to answer one that way.
Yeah.
Well, a couple things real quick. I know that the county commissioners, their focus isn't to try and prevent people from doing what is their right to do. When they look at these things, you look at the courthouse, it's been under construction since, I think, the 50s. I mean, there's always something being built or fixed or something around the courthouse. It is a gathering space to where the public is entitled to do what they need to do there because it's government stuff. And the government can't say you can go here and you can't go there on your property because your taxpayers bought it. But there has always been the error on the side of public safety. And I know to some degree that has been one of the major drivers of a lot of the policy that's been made, not just at the county level, but also at the city level.
That's the argument. It's false because what happened was a pro-marijuana mm-hmm. group said, we want to protest. The commissioner said no. The marijuana group sued and the court said, of course you can go.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that. But all I know is that how traditionally a lot of these things are thought of and how they end up working out. Some say that the first knee-jerk reaction was during the nativity thing. And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they went to put a nativity.
Sure. And this has happened in a lot of Indiana communities, we should say. And that's a totally different argument because
sure
then you're talking about church and state.
Correct.
And you've got all sorts of stuff. But, mm-hmm. but the pro-marijuana group or heck, if you want to take it completely the other side, what if the KKK wanted to host an ostensibly peaceful protest, leaving aside whether such a thing is possible?
They did, and they did it at the courthouse.
So, I mean, you've got
I had to work that, by the way.
Possibilities on both sides, but the First Amendment says both sides are equally mm-hmm. allowed to do such things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you're basically validating what has taken place. But I'm talking more specifically about how it gets to be that controversial, I guess, is the best word to use it. And I know that usually these conversations, and I'm never involved because it's not my building. It used to be my police district when I was a cop, but it's not my building.
We should also point out that one of the reasons I'm asking you about this is you've attended a couple of gatherings in the last year or two at the courthouse,
mm-hmm.
Following President Trump's inauguration, mm-hmm. talking about RFRA, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this is something you've participated in.
Mm-hmm.
Are you hoping that that happens more? That there are more ability, more frankly, just total more demonstrations.
There is no better way to express public opinion than by having a public gathering to do so. I think that they're neat. I think that they serve a great purpose in any society. And I think that if we get to the point where we're going to start inhibiting that, we need to look over our shoulders and maybe across a couple oceans and see how bad things can go. But the other side of it is I think, as it was during the rallies we went to after the recent presidential elections, they were coordinated. They were safe. People were respectful. Police officers did a great job of making sure the traffic flow was coordinated. It ended up being a very positive and very pleasant event.
All right. Well, Mr. Mayor, thanks as always. That's the time we've got, and we'll look forward to doing it again.
I'll be here.
All right. Enjoy standing along State Street in a couple of weeks.
Yeehaw. Come by.
I will.
All right.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember, you can find all of these programs archived at our website. That's WBAA.org. And if at any time you'd like to send questions in for any of our four mayors, email ask@WBAA.org, tweet @WBAA News on Twitter, or call in during the programs. Our next conversation will be with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski at this time next week. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Have a good rest of your day.